Okay, so just to begin by framing the discussion a little bit, I have to start with a story that takes us back to pre-war Germany, say 1935. There was a man by the name of Moshe Rabinowitz, and he was a wealthy businessman. He owned a few factories, and as the Nazis came to power and things started to look a little bit risky for the Jews, so he decided it was time to pick up his family and come to America. So he obviously had a lot of assets that he had built up in Germany. It wasn't so easy for him to part with that. So what he did was he sold the business and he took all of his cash and put it into gold. But in order to be able to travel inconspicuously across the ocean to America, he decided to have all the gold converted, to be melted into sets of gold teeth. And this way he could get to the customs office and no one would suspect anything. So he was able to put everything into five sets of gold teeth. But the only thing was when he got to America, so he gets off the boat, and the customs officials say, okay, you know, we understand one set of gold teeth, maybe, but why, sir, do you need five sets of gold teeth? So he says, well, you know, I'm a religious Jew, and as you know, we have separate dishes, we have dairy dishes, we have meat dishes, so I have to have one set of dentures for my milkshakes and one set of dentures for my fellatiques. So he says, okay, sir, I understand, but that accounts for two. What about the other three? So he says, well, you know, there's also a holiday known as Passover. And Passover, we're very careful to keep all chametz away from the food that we eat. So as a result, I need to have another couple sets of teeth in order to make sure that I have what to eat with on Yontif. So he says, okay, sir, I understand. You must be a deeply religious man if you have meat and dairy for the whole year, and you have meat and dairy for Pesach also, but what about the fifth set? So he sort of under his breath mumbles to the customs official, well, actually every once in a while I like to have a ham sandwich too. So when I heard this joke, so at first, you know, it's a little bit funny, but at the same time when you think about it, so you also, you know, you have to think twice and wonder, okay, so what exactly is the deal? Because, you know, no one has multiple sets of teeth. But at the same time, if we have separate sets of dishes, so then why don't we have to have separate sets of teeth also? So I didn't put too much thought into it, but then a few weeks later, a friend of mine in the Beis Midrash, someone who I think overlapped with in Smich a little bit in YU, so he happened to mention to me casually as part of another conversation that his grandmother has two sets of dentures. So when I heard that, I said, wait a second, maybe there's really something to this, or maybe his grandmother is, you know, picking up some new chumrah from... And it made me wonder, okay, maybe there's a little more to look into over here. Now, the first thing that struck me is a Gemara which we're familiar with in terms of what emerges from this Gemara in source number one, but it's really not going to get us out of the woods so quickly. The Gemara says, Amar Rav Chisda achal basar asa lechal gvina. Once a person eats meat, so he's not allowed to have cheese, gvina motar lechal basar, but you don't have the same restrictions after cheese if you want to eat meat afterwards. Amar le Rav Acha bar Yosef le Rav Chisda, basar shebein ha-shinayim mahu. Okay, so let's say I waited between the meat that I had and the cheese that I had later, but I still find meat in between my teeth. So, Kari Aleh, he quoted a pasuk to him, HaBasar Odenu Bein Shinehem. This is the story with the Slav in Bamidbar, and the Torah over there refers to the meat that was still stuck in their teeth before they were punished by Hashem for complaining that they didn't have enough meat. It still calls it meat while it's in their teeth, while there are little pieces stuck between their teeth. So the lesson the Gemara tells us that emerges from this Gemara is that even though it's been a few hours, it's been 6 hours, let's say, since you had that meat, as long as there's still particles in between your teeth, you still have to be mindful of it. And, okay, so if that happened to someone, so they'd have to brush their teeth and then they'd have milkshakes. So that's not so surprising because we can understand if you have meat in your mouth, so you can't have milkshakes also. But if we deal with that, so again, we've only dealt with only half of the story. Because in the end of the day, the reason we have separate dishes and for milkshakes and for fellatiques has nothing to do with, you know, finding dirt and scraps from the last meal on the dishes. Obviously, you wash your dishes well, so there's nothing left on the dishes, but there's something in the dishes that we assume could be problematic if you go from milkshakes to fellatiques, and that's the reason we have the separate dishes. So if that's the case, we have to extrapolate that the teeth should, again, beyond what the Gemara is talking about over there, little pieces of meat in your teeth, we have to talk about the taste that's absorbed in the dishes. So while we analyze that question, so truth is, first let's take a quick survey of the sources, understanding what it is exactly that brings us to the notion of having the separate dishes because there's taste absorbed in the dishes, and then that'll be a good framework to begin discussing what exactly is the reason we don't have two sets of teeth, if in fact Ellie is correct. But I'll, as I said before, we'll give it to you. But don't leave halfway before this year's over.
I'm beginning to wonder now.
Okay, good. All right, that's a point. All right, anyway, the title got at least a dentist in, so we're okay. All right, so if you look in source number two, so this is the story of the war with Moab right before Moshe's death. Elazar HaKohen al Anshei HaTzava HaBoim lo Melchama Zos Chukas HaTorah Shertziv Hashem es Moshe. Elazar HaKohen succeeding his father Aaron. At the end of the 40 years in the desert, after they successfully vanquish the enemy, so they come back with all kinds of spoils of war, and he instructs the soldiers, okay, this is what you have to do with all the pots and pans that you took from the goyim. Achas hazov es hakesef es hanachoshes es habarzel es habedil ves hoferes. You have all these kalim, these vessels made out of gold, silver, copper, several types of metals. Okay, kol davar sheyavo be'ish tavir be'ish, any type of vessel, pots, pans that were used in fire have to be koshered with fire. V'toher, and then they'll become purified. Ach b'meini da yischatov, but they still have to be brought to the mikveh, like we toivel kalim that come from goyim. V'chol asher lo yavo be'ish tavir b'mayim. Any type of vessel, any type of, could be forks and spoons, whatever, that aren't used in direct contact with fire, but they're just used with, let's say, cold non-kosher foods, you know, which you have to assume because that's where you got it from the non-Jews, so they don't have to be exposed to the official koshering process with heat, with Haggalah, with Levon, but rather it's enough just to clean them off, okay? So that's the basis for why we have a need to kosher kalim if we get it from a non-kosher source, and as a result, the implication is that there's something absorbed in the kalim once they've been used for non-kosher food. Likewise, the actual source of the prohibition of basar b'chalav also gives us that same impression, because the way the Torah says it three times across the Chamisha Chumshei Torah, lo sevashal gedi b'chalev imo. You may not cook literally the gedi, a kid, in his mother's milk. Okay, so the implication is that if I would not cook the meat in the milk, but I would just let it soak there all day, it would be kosher. I could take out the milk and just drink it, and that would be fine. And that's true on a doraisa level. That's correct. Why? Because since the Torah only formulates basar b'chalav in the context of cooking, so it means only when you cook is there a transfer of taste, again, this heat, or when it's exposed to fire, like the source we saw before. That's the transfer of taste that occurs when the items that you're cooking are heated up. Okay, so that's the basis for why we have the separate dishes. And finally, in source number four, this is brought down, again, in the most practical sense, the instructions that tell us how to organize our kitchen. Kedeir shebisho ba basar. If you have a pot that you cooked meat in it, lo yivashu b'chalav, you can't also cook in that same pot milk. Then bisho ba besof ma'es la'es, asher b'nosin tam. And if you did cook the opposite, the milk cooks in the fleishik pot within 24 hours, so then potentially you're going to asher whatever, you know, the macaroni and cheese that you're cooking. Aval m'shoa ma'es la'es, kodim shebisho ba, but if 24 hours elapsed, and we'll get back to this, this is the notion of eino ben yomo, it's not within 24 hours of the first use of that pot for fleishiks. So havelei nosing tam levgam, we assume that the taste in the walls of the pot it's somewhat expired or somewhat spoiled, and as a result not as potent to affect what's cooked in the pot the second time around. Umutzer hatavshil, so the food is permissible. Avakadera asher levashel ba lo basar v'lechol. This is perhaps one of the most common questions that a rabbi gets at dinner time. Let's say exactly that story. Someone had a fleishik pot, and they realized after they had already cooked the macaronis and cheese, that it was a fleishik pot. The first question a rabbi has to ask is always, when was the last time you used that pot for fleishiks? Okay, and most of the time, the answer is going to be, it was, 2 days ago, 3 days ago. Okay, so 24 hours have elapsed. So the result is, you can go ahead with your dinner, b'tei avon, the macaronis and cheese are permissible, but you're going to have to kosher the pot, because the pot now has milchiks and fleishiks taste inside of it, but the food is unaffected because it's been more than 24 hours since the fleishik taste went in. Okay, so that's all the background. But we could also suggest that everything that's written in that pasuk, right? I tried to highlight that we're talking about the spoils of war that were made out of a specific type of material, namely metals. Okay, everything mentioned in that pasuk in source number two, pasuk habez, they're all metals. Okay, so what does that have to do with teeth? All right, so we know that we do extend milks and fleishiks outside of strictly metal pots. Okay, you have separate sets of china, you have plastic for sure. So how do you know it applies to teeth as well? So for that, you have source number five. This is a line from the Shulchan Aruch Harav. Echad kli mateches, whether it's a metal kli, echad kli eitz, if it's wooden, kli glolim, for lack of a better term, made out of fertilizer, kli avanim, stoneware, kli adama, earthenware, ve echad kli etzim, Kli Etzem is that which is made out of bone. Okay, so we assume, and please tell me if I'm wrong factually on any of these things, but the primary components of your teeth mirror the material that your bones are made out of? Is that the calcium?
Similar. There's more calcium.
There's more calcium in the teeth than in the... okay. So we'll assume for this, for our purposes, that they're more or less the same. So the in summation, what that source tells us is that anything made out of those materials, the expanded list, the Torah didn't mean to limit it only to those six metals, so they're subject to the laws of absorbing taste. Although that pasuk is simultaneously a possible source why many assume, most assume, you don't have to toggle an aluminum pan, something like that. Besides the fact that it's disposable, which is an important factor, but also aluminum is not on that list of metals. And we mentioned one of the things that's learned from this pasuk is the fact that you have to toggle dishes you get from non-Jews. So aluminum, you know, it's part of our, you know, much broader periodic table, but in those days, there were only a few metals that are on the list, so that's perhaps one reason why you don't have to title it, because it wasn't one of the metals that was either known or commonly used at the time that the Torah was given. Okay, so that's the basis for what we're talking about. So now that we know that our teeth are like that, so the dentures are going to be the same thing as well, and once we're talking on the, once we're speaking about the metals, so you have to talk about fillings as well, okay, because you can have a metal component. What are white fillings made out of?
It's a type of plastic.
Okay, so plastic is going to be part of the discussion also. But certainly someone who has a silver filling or a mercury, is that the that's what it's made out of. Okay, so the first person that I'm aware of to address this on paper, okay, goes back about 100, 150 years ago. In source number 7, Darkei Tshuva writes as follows. If you look in that first column on the right, let's say about 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 lines down. Okay, v'chein. It's the right in the center of the line. V'chein, v'chein. K'shayisi b'vien. When I was in Vienna, sha'alti l'rofe mumcha gadol v'uman basias hashinayim mahu tochen hashinayim halalu. The author of the Darkei Tshuva said. The author of the She'ela Shalom, who he's quoting, said I was in Vienna and I asked an expert dentist what exactly are dentures made of. V'amrli v'misiak v'itumo shehu naisa mimin echad. Hamuva me America, some sort of material that they bring from America. Shavitivo inubalei shum blua lasocho ki chen yistu harofim lasosu miminze dafka shehu meahechrich. It has to be made out of an impervious material. Okay, they were under the impression that the material that they were importing from America to create the to create the dentures were not porous at all. Why? Because if they were, then it would invite infection, it would invite bacteria growth inside the mouth, which would be dangerous for whoever it was that was having his teeth replaced. And ultimately cause illness and be counterproductive. So he says something fascinating. This my friend's grandmother is not so crazy, okay? Because the conclusion of the Darkei Tshuva was that reportedly these teeth are not subject to the laws of milchus infleishik because they can't absorb anything. Again, that was their scientific, according to their scientific knowledge. But nevertheless, he said, you know what, we're not 100% sure, so it would be a good idea to have separate sets for milchus infleishik, and for sure Pesach, which obviously the stakes are much higher when it comes to chametz, it's worthwhile to have a second set. Okay, so also from a scientific perspective, which again, it's hard to determine how it matches up with the materials they were dealing with, but the OU commissioned metallurgists, scientists who specialize in metal, to use radioactive isotopes to experiment with your regular, you know, household pot to see what exactly, to what extent, taste travels within, you know, within the things you use in your kitchen. So what they found was they whatever they made, spaghetti, they treated it with radioactive isotopes, and after they finished cooking it, they got rid of everything that was in the pot. They examined the metal of the pot itself to see if it was tagged, if there were tagged molecules in there, and I think they were able to determine that at least 1/4 inch penetration takes place, again from at least within their experimentation, of taste particles into the walls of the pot. Okay, so it's not something which, you know, sometimes people think that the when we talk about taste absorbed in pots, you know, it's like some mystical mystery that we don't really know how it works, but it's been substantiated scientifically. Okay, and you know, you can buy also these wooden cherry plates for cooking, for grilling salmon, you know, because that's reality. That's reality. Okay, so what are we going to do with this? Okay, we know we're dealing with something tangible, in a sense. So what about the teeth? All right, so we're going to take a couple approaches, some better than others, and hopefully by the end we'll be able to put it together and have some justification for what we do. So starting with what we already mentioned, there is a notion of after 24 hours, the taste expiring. Okay, so now that's true, and in the scenario we discussed before about a person who calls a rabbi at dinner time, it's correct that after 24 hours, the pot is no longer potent in terms of prohibiting whatever you cook in there. But at the same time, that doesn't give you license to now use the pot l'chatchila to cook the milk that's inside, right? The reason for that is that Chazal, on a Darabonim level, instituted that even though after 24 hours, on a Torah level, there's no more taste extant in the walls of the pot, but Midrabanan, we're going to say you can't use it because it's very easy to get mixed up, because if you don't have that limitation, then you may very well use the pot for the macaroni and cheese the same day or the day after, less than 24 hours, after you made the meatballs. Okay? So l'chatchila you can't get away with that, so this isn't really going to help us too much, because even if, okay, what are you going to tell me? One night I have pizza, okay, so Thursday night is my pizza night, and then Friday night, that's when I have my chicken soup. Okay, but 24 hours have gone by, let's say, in theory. Okay, so that's fine, but l'chatchila we would never tell you to use the same pots Thursday night and then Friday night again for the fleishiks. So if you look at source number 9, historically, this is a fascinating statement of Tosus. If we go back to medieval times in Europe, so not everyone had an oven in their home. Most people didn't. There was one big baker's oven in the town, and everyone would come and either bake their bread or they would store their cholent there Friday night, and then Shabbos morning they would take it out. And what Tosfos discusses is if we're using the same baker's oven for our bread as the goyim are, the local goyim in town, so we should have a similar problem. They're spreading lard or whatever trefa oils on the on the pizza shovel, whatever you call that puts the bread in and out. I don't know. The Tosfos has a word called a morda, and that's the best I can do, a pizza shovel
peel
thing. What's that called?
It's called peel.
Peel. Thank you very much. Okay, forget my what language is that? Is that English? Is English? Okay. I figure it should be like Italian or something like that. It's, okay.
Maybe you come from Italian.
All right. Okay. I learn new things every day. All right. So Tosfos says, how do we deal with that? So Tosfos says the only way to explain the apparently the commonly held practice at the time to share the oven with the goyim was that, yes, it's true when it comes to in your own home and you have the luxury of the different pots. So Chazal said you have to have a fleishik pot and you have to have a milchik pot, and you can't l'chatchila use one for the other. However, when it comes to bread, there's no other way for us to make bread. And bread is the basic staple of life. We find a number of kulas in halacha, such as the whole practice that we have nowadays of pas palter, and we're not makbid on pas akum in the same way we're makbid on bishul akum, is because you can't get by without bread. Rishonim say that the bread is the basic staple, and as a result, we have to be a little more lenient in order to be practical. So Tosfos says it must be that in order to survive, Chazal had to sort of waive the normal standards of not being able to use something after 24 hours, and here they said as long as it's been 24 hours since the goyim used the peel, so then you're okay. So maybe we have to say the same. Maybe we can say the same thing when it comes to the teeth, that as long as it's not within 24 hours, which again, you know, that's not going to solve all of our problems yet. But the only way to live is if you have, you know, your set of teeth that you can use for milchiks and fleishiks. So we'll say it's under the same rubric of Chazal had to give us a break over here because there's no other way to get by. In addition to that, Rav Shlomo Zalman has a fascinating svara. Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach said that maybe the 24-hour rule is correct in the normal kitchen environment, but maybe inside your mouth, at the temperatures inside your mouth, and the saliva and the breakdown of the enzymes, that, you know, everything is moving it's a different type of environment in there. Maybe you move faster. Maybe it speeds things up. So even the 24 hours isn't necessary. You can get by after a shorter period of time. And earlier, Poskim, already going back to the Chassam Sofer, in a more primitive application, I guess you could say, talks about stuff caught in the inside of your cavities. Okay, so maybe also things that are so deeply recessed, they're not subject to the same rules because things move a little more quickly. So I asked Rav Schefter if this is a good approach, you know, working with the comparison to the bakery oven and speeding things up inside the mouth. So his response was, Kein yehi ratzon. So it sounds like he wasn't really convinced, but we got to hope that there's something, okay? So that's one approach, but given the fact that he wasn't so thrilled with that, maybe we'll try another perspective on this. Okay, so the next question is maybe the rabbi's second tool in his toolbox when he gets to Shiloh. Okay, and this is something which is familiar to us in other contexts. In Hilchos Shabbos, in the laws of Bishul, so we know that there's a standard of a temperature known as Yad Sol Et Esbo. Okay, not clear exactly what this temperature is, but it's the minimum temperature for food to be subject to the prohibition of cooking. Okay, namely, if you had a fire, open on your stove, and you took something uncooked and put it on the fire, if you knew for sure, okay, based on the size of the fire, whatever it is, that the food is never going to reach this heat of Yad Sol Et Esbo, so then there's no prohibition. Okay, the only problem is to put it in an environment where it's going to reach that temperature. Okay, the Gemara tells us this source number 12. Okay, in the context again of Bishul, Amar Yehuda, Amar Shmuel, Echad Shemen, Echad Mayim, Yad Sol Et Esbo Aser, Ein Yad Sol Et Esbo Moter. If it is at the temperature of Yad Sol Et Esbo, what does Yad Sol Et Esbo mean? Rashi, a little bit lower down in 12, says, Nimshecha la'achoreha midaiga shel techve. Yad Sol Et Esbo means it's hot enough that if you stuck your hand inside, you would recoil because of the heat. Okay? Still not so clear if we have to put that on a thermometer what that means. The Gemara says further, because I don't know, everyone has different sensitivities. You know, some people are more sensitive, some people are less. So the Gemara says on the second line there, Hechidam Yad Sol Et Esbo, so how do we evaluate it? Amar Rachba kosha kreisel shel tinok nichves. Whatever temperature it is that the stomach of a baby would be singed or burned. Okay, so
they find that out.
Okay, so as I said, we're still vague on this. Okay, that's not the kind of thing you want to play around with. Okay, don't try this at home. But it gives us some impression. Okay, that we can begin working with in order to try to determine what this mysterious temperature is. But before we get that far, take a look at the last page you have in your handout. There are two sides there. These are top secret classified internal documents from the OU. Okay, so please don't pass them out beyond the shir. But OU has thousands of documents recording their policies, recording individual scenarios that came up in various factories in order to maintain a certain consistent standard for how things are judged. So page M5 is an excerpt from the master list of temperatures. And here, Yad Sol Et Esbo is 120 degrees. Okay. Now, just to illustrate this, because as I said before, this comes up a lot at home, the temperature for cooking, we're going to parallel and say that's the same temperature for heat and taste transfer when it comes to kashrus. Okay. So if the rabbi gets a call about the macaroni and cheese while it's still on the fire, okay, or the whoever was cooking it shut off the fire right away and then called the rabbi, so the rabbi may ask, well, how hot, was it there for 10 minutes or was it there for 30 seconds? And often, it's usually pretty quick before whoever's cooking realizes that it was a fleshic pot. They'll say, okay, you turned it on for 10 seconds, all right, so that's, it never reached 120 degrees, so just clean out the whole pot and you're good. This sometimes scares people. No, what do you mean? I had it was on the fire and I had my macaroni and cheese inside the pot. That's it. Clean it out well with, soap and water. This is the key. This, some rabbis make a mistake on. First, clean it out with cold water. If you don't tell the people to do that, they'll turn on their hot water, like they always wash the dishes, and then end up taking all the cheese that's at the bottom of the pot and having it transfer into the pot. So you just shot yourself in the foot. But if you clean it out well with cold water and soap, and then you're good. So a couple practical examples. If you look on the back side of the page, that's a real factory scenario. Cheese factory heats cheese products at temperatures never exceeding 109 degrees Fahrenheit. Higher temperatures would ruin the products. The company wishes to prepare power product on the same machinery, okay? So kosherization is not needed for the new production to be considered power, even though the machinery was exposed to direct heat, okay? Because as long as it didn't reach 120 degrees, all you have to do is just clean it off, and then you can use that same machinery in the factory, for power. All right? So that's, the OU as a chumrah uses the temperature of 120 degrees.
It's pretty low.
It sounds kind of low. Rabbi Shachter told me that the Rav held it was 140 degrees. So I asked him, how did he know that? So he said, in the Rav's own voice, imitating the Rav's own voice, he said, personal experience. So maybe that's a... So there are different views on the postcard if you can use that test, right? Maybe that's the way to do it. Just, keep sticking your hand in and experiment. But as Rabbi Willig points out, that's not the best way to do it because when you're expecting the heat, when you're bracing yourself for the fact that, I'm doing an experiment over here, so then you're not going to be so quick to recoil because you're aware that, you can tolerate the heat better when you're expecting it, okay? So the real way to do it is, again, that unfortunate baby who's not expecting it, God forbid, that's the measure, Okay, so maybe that's why the Gemara uses that example. I don't know. But so let's it's somewhere between 120, 140. Some have it a little bit higher. It's hard to know. But there is another approach to try to figure this out. And the most common shiloh when you have to deal with the temperatures is in the sink. People accidentally wash milk insufflations together in the sink. So how hot was the water in the sink is not so easy to determine. Another measure for this heat, if you look in source 14, this is a quotation from the Kaf HaChaim, but it's actually based on earlier sources, the Rajba and others.
I know, by the way, the hot water in this building is over 130 degrees sometimes.
Oh, really? Okay.
I've measured it.
How do you, you have like a water thermometer?
I've got
one of those.
Infrared thermometer.
So I've tried those, they're very inaccurate. You can, if you hold it like an inch, you know, back or an inch forward.
And it also has a probe.
Oh, yeah? Oh, okay. Oh, that's a real deal. Okay.
Yeah, I'm looking to that. It's kind of dangerous.
Okay. All right, that's good to know. So that's pretty hot. So the Kaf HaChaim, if you see, Miu Ayin L'Kaman Simen Kof Hei Sevez, Dechom She'en Yad Soledes Bo L'Kuli Alma Eino Ma'afur Ma'afliya, V'im Kein Zeh Ha'ochel Vaday She'eno Yochel Lechel Dover She'yad Soledes Bo Machmas Chomo. So he says, wait a second. Whatever this temperature is, doesn't it make sense to say that if you're eating the food, how could it possibly be that hot? Because if it's such an intolerable heat that if you touch it, you bounce back. So it's hard to imagine that it's in your mouth and you're just chewing it and swallowing it. Okay, so maybe that's our way out. Maybe the reason why you don't have to be worried about two sets of teeth is because there never is a taste transfer within your mouth because it's not really that hot. Okay.
However,
yeah,
you accidentally.
Oh, okay, excellent, excellent.
It happens to everyone.
Excellent, right. Okay.
The hot pizza burning in the roof of your mouth.
Right. So some people, you know, if it's hot, you spit it out. If you're like me, I still don't learn my lesson. I usually end up swallowing it. Okay, and then I regret it.
Sorry. And you would say then, because you spit it out, there wasn't enough time for the teeth to heat up.
That's an excellent suggestion. We'll come back to that. That's an interesting angle. We'll come back to that. It's a good suggestion.
The average coffee drinker's coffee is way hotter than 100.
Okay. All right. So I spoke to people in food services about this. Okay, so because some people point out what Ellie's pointing out, that you make a mistake sometimes, okay, you taste the chicken soup and it's just too hot for you, chillin' sometimes, but you heated it to perfection, Daniel, thank you, okay. So it basically, I think tea, let's say your average caterer is served at about 158 degrees, okay, and I'm sure we've all been at a restaurant or hotel where there's some, you know, old bubby who, you know, if her tea is not piping hot, she's going to send it back to the, you know, to the kitchen to get a new one. But apparently, coffee, I guess when under the regulation of the health department, cannot be served at under 175 degrees. I think 178, something like that. And apparently, the real coffee connoisseurs will tell you that unless it's at 175 degrees, the taste is not fully extracted from the beans. Okay, you look like you know about this stuff.
So someone sued McDonald's because they got burned from their coffee.
That's right. So. That's right. Okay, but
it's hot.
I don't think they were such a big connoisseur. No, that was their 99-cent. You know.
Nobody.
Okay, so that's so that would be kind of difficult with this approach because like Ellie said, sometimes it just is that hot and you make a mistake. But certainly if you're willing to sip it slowly, there's no question that you could be eating something which is certainly hotter than that. On the flip side, this is putting the temperatures higher. There is one novel approach from Zalman Auerbach again in his scientific approach to halacha, came up with a number which is I think 114 degrees. Okay, the reason he arrived at that number is because the Gemara says that when you shecht an animal, okay, so the blood is treif obviously, does not get absorbed into the knife that you shecht with. And if it did, it would be a problem if you shafted another animal, okay, with a bloody knife. And what that indicates is that the point at which the animal is shafted is certainly not hot enough to absorb the treif blood taste into the knife. So Shlomo Zalman says, all we know from the Gemara is that temperature is below the requisite yatzo ledesbo. But in theory, we have to be concerned that anything above that temperature is fair game for absorption. So he did a little experimentation and found that the animal with the lowest body temperature at the neck during Shechita is the goose at 114 degrees. So he said, maybe we have to be concerned from 114 degrees and up already that's where, you know, the breaking point is. Okay, does that make sense?
I would think the opposite, though.
What would you say?
That proves that anything lower than that is fine.
Right, so he said, therefore, anything above that
might
be. It's fair game. So maybe we should...
But if the goose is the lowest one,
right?
Let's say the cow is 150.
Right, but the Gemara doesn't specify. The Gemara just says...
Right, but then it has to be above 150. It would have to be above the highest one, because otherwise the knife is treif.
I hear what you're saying. Okay, could be I'm missing something in the cheshbon. Let me think about that. I'll have to get back to you. Okay, I hear what you're saying.
Animals walk around at 114 degrees.
At the neck? Is that what you said? Yeah.
No.
So I don't know what body, what physical changes take place at shechita. Like, I don't know if there's some sort of increased molecular movement.
What's the temperature of our blood? Is it 98.6? Or is the blood at a higher temperature than the rest of the body? I don't know.
I think you don't know what the medical background is. I thought the blood temperature is 98.6.
Yeah. But body temperature, the same temperature as your blood?
I think so.
I don't know.
I'll tell you, I got a cut yesterday. I didn't burn myself when I was going to band aid, you know. Baruch Hashem. So I have to get back to you about that. It could be that what Shlomo Zalman meant was that the Gemara is at least talking about the lowest temperature. So you're right, so the animal... now I hear what you're saying, but then there would be a problem at the larger animals. Okay. All right, so we'll focus on that another time, but that's a fair question. Okay, thank you. All right, so that's in terms of Yatzel Letzbo. So again, we're not quite out of the woods because we do eat very hot food sometimes. All right, so now our next attempt is going to be the distinction that we have in Halacha between Kli Rishon and Kli Sheni. Okay, there's also something that we have a little more exposure to in Hilchos Shabbos. And I have a couple sources of this on page 3 of the sources, the handouts there, starting with 17. Okay, the Gemara in Shabbos, Mishnah actually tells us as follows: Ha'ilchas Bakadeir, if you have a pan or a pot, Shevdiron Merusachin. Okay, Lo Yitin Losachin Tavlin. So Friday night, you have, let's say you left your stove on, okay, because you wanted your chicken soup piping hot for the meal. So you take the chicken soup right off the oven. Or right off the stove, so you're not supposed to add uncooked spices into the pot that just came off the fire. Why? Because that's a Kli Rishon. Okay, so Kli Rishon, when it's at that requisite temperature of Yatzel Letzbo, will cook whatever's placed inside. Okay, so as a result, you can't put things inside. However, the Mishnah continues and says that if you transfer the chicken soup into a bowl and you put it on the table, so then you can add things to the pot, because Kli Sheni, in general, The second transfer is not mevashel. Okay, that's why we have a practice. If you use a tea bag on Shabbos, let's say, so the best way to do it is to transfer it a couple times from the original place where it's cooked to we really do kli shlishi, because there are certain things that are more we'll say vulnerable to heat in a kli sheni. But Rav Moshe Feinstein says if you put in a kli shlishi, such as a tea bag, it's okay. But again, once there's that sequence of transferring from one to the other, so there's room to believe that the cooking doesn't take place. The same is true, to some extent, when it comes to kashrus. In the same way that anything under Yatzel Letzbo isn't considered cooking, and therefore it's not a heat transfer, when it comes to Kli Sheni also, we're not going to be at risk from a kashrus perspective. So we have to ask ourselves, the food that we eat, so is that a Kli Rishon or a Kli Sheni? So it's just about always going to be a Kli Sheni, because unless you take that chicken soup off the stove and pour it down like that, right, you're going to put it into a bowl, and then your spoon, and there might be a ladle in between. Okay, ladle is questionable because it depends on how long the ladle stays in the pot, because sometimes if you just leave the ladle in there for a while, then it's tantamount to being on the fire in the Kli Rishon itself. But you may have 2, 3, 4 transfers by the time it gets to your mouth. Okay, so that's a big help over here, because if you assume that certainly lechatchila, it could be that if someone trafes something up in a Kli Sheni, we might try to kosher it anyway. But in this case, when again we're stuck because we only have one set of teeth, so you could be good. You could be good with that. Okay. The only problem is when it comes to Pesach. Pesach is not so simple because Pesach or machmer even on a Kli Sheni, all these things, anything you can come up with on Basar B'chalav during the year, Pesach or machmer. That example before about the macaroni and the meatballs, if that would be a chametz and a non-chametz dish on Pesach, the rabbi gets a call on Pesach, I accidentally cooked my chicken soup in a chametzik pot, then we're not going to be able, at least Ashkenazim are not allowed to eat the chicken soup, even if it's been a week since you cooked in that pot, because we don't have all the coolers that we operate with during the year on Pesach as well. Okay, it's important to keep in mind. So One thing also to bear in mind is that when it comes to even Kli Rishon and Kli Sheni, we're not totally out of the woods, because there's another concept known as Davar Gush. Davar Gush is a solid. Okay, solid foods tend to retain heat much better and much longer than chicken soup. Okay, the reason for that, Tosfos explains, is because if you put chicken soup from one pot to another to your bowl, so the bowl is cold, right? So the you don't have augmenting the heat, the Kli that it's in, because the walls of that Kli are cold. Whereas the chicken soup pot on the stove, so that, you know, you have a hot soup and hot pot, so it maintains the heat. Once you transfer it into the bowl, so it's going to cool down a little bit because the bowl itself is cool. The spoon is cool. But if you have a potato, so, you know, if you put a potato in a microwave and you slice it open, you know, you have like an explosion of steam, and it'll maintain that heat for a long time, even if the outer walls of the item is cold. Which is, when we talk about the microwave, is also a funny permutation of this. There's a debate as to whether a microwave has a din of a Kli Rishon or a Kli Sheni, because a microwave, the walls never get hot. Right? So as we just said, the whole reason why something has that super status of Kli Rishon is because the food is in a utensil with hot walls that augment the heat. But that's not the case when it comes to a microwave, because the walls usually stay cool. So what happens when you bite into your cholent and you realize that the potato was way too hot? So even if it is theoretically a klisheni, when it comes to solids, l'chatchil at least, we're a little more careful, certainly on Pesach, to treat it as having the ability to transfer taste as well. Okay, so we're still stuck over here. Okay, so I'm going to mention two things to wrap it up. All right, and hopefully we'll have a conclusion in a minute, and then maybe one more wrinkle to think about. All right, so one thing, basically where we're standing so far is that Eina Ben Yoma, waiting 24 hours is not going to help you. Okay. Number two is the temperature is not going to be a big help either. The transfer of Kli Rishon to Kli Sheni is getting there. Okay, I hate to say we're warm, terrible pun, but the Davar Gush may foil our plans. Okay, what Ellie mentioned is an important consideration. Is there a time, a prerequisite of time that the, let's say, the milchik item has to be in the flesh, in contact with the fleshik dish for there to be a transfer of taste. Even if the temperature is right, it's off at 200 degrees. But maybe if something spills on a surface and I wipe it up immediately, maybe there's nothing to talk about. And therefore, if I bit something and I spit it out, or for that matter, it was the chicken soup and I swallowed it right away, so maybe it wasn't in my mouth, it wasn't in contact with my teeth for long enough to pose a problem. So there's an interesting proof lacula over here in the process of kashering. When you kasher something, let's say you boil up a pot of hot water, boiling hot water, and you put a tray fork and you drop it inside. So how long does it have to be inside the boiling water? Anyone ever attend a kashering for Pesach or something like that? Momentarily, even for a second. Okay, it's there, you take it out. So strictly speaking, we would consider that kosher. Again, sometimes some posts can suggest leave it in there for a few seconds, but strictly speaking, if it was in and out, so then it's okay. So that would indicate that there's a taste transfer immediately. But not everyone agrees to that. Some say that if it's only a second and you got rid of it right away, then no taste transfer actually occurred. Now, we don't usually rely on that, but in a tight spot, when there's other factors, we will rely on that. So this is certainly a tough spot where this comes into play. Okay, so this might help us. What's gonna cause more problems, though, is the question of a davar charif. Okay, davar charif is the old onion, okay, with a fleshik knife. Okay, and then I realize afterwards I have a milchik meal and I'm serving the onion that was cut with a fleshik. So what exactly is the issue with the onion? Why are onions like everyone's afraid of onions and kashrus? So the issue is because even though what we said before is that after 24 hours, there's no potency in the taste inside the pot, inside the fork, whatever it is, to affect the macaroni and cheese inside the fleshik pot. However, if that item comes in contact with something spicy, something sharp, something like an onion, so even if it's been more than 24 hours, that taste is reinvigorated. Okay, so if I cut hot meat with this knife 3 weeks ago, all right, so plenty of time has elapsed, but now I cut the onion with that knife, then even though it's been 3 weeks, this is now a fleshik onion. Okay, and I would not be able to melt cheese on top. I couldn't put it on top of my pizza or whatever. Okay, so that's why it's best to have like a parv knife for cutting vegetables like that for that type of scenario. So the problem is, your teeth are, certainly your canine teeth, are no different than a knife in their capacity to cut through, you know, and you could be cutting through something sharp. You take a bite of an onion, okay? There's no difference between the action that that's playing itself out with a knife slicing through the onion and your teeth slicing through an onion, okay? So it means that a lot of these factors, even when there's no heat involved, there can be a taste transfer as a result of your teeth going through the onion, because that's another factor when it comes to the knife cutting the onion. We say that there's a taste transfer even if there's no actual heat that you can feel, because there's something about the sharp taste of the onion that affects that transfer of taste. Okay, so again, now your mouth is totally cold and the food is totally cold, and there's still something to be concerned about. And when it comes to Pesach, so if you're from the adventurers who like to eat real horseradish for your mara, okay, I think an emergency room doctor told me that the highest incidence of Jewish emergency room visits is Pesach night, because people get all macho with their horseradish. But if that's the case, so wait a second. So if your teeth really are chametzdik, so now your mara is going to be chametzdik at the Seder, right before you have your matzah. So now you're really in trouble. So before we give one thing, which I think is the punchline, which will hopefully take care of everything, there are poskim. Okay, you can take a look in source number 22. This is alluded to. But there are plenty of other sources that substantiate this. There were certain tzaddikim who would, A, not eat anything hot on Pesach itself, okay, and they would not eat any davar charav, any spicy things, on Pesach either. And could be they would use romaine lettuce, I don't know. Some say that if you chop up the horseradish finely enough, okay, then it doesn't have that same status of being a davar charav, which could be, I'm not sure. That's one approach that some have. Okay, some have the approach that that instead of on Pesach being machmir, more important to, in order to preserve Simchas Yontif, make sure you can really enjoy yourself on Yontif. You can't hold people back like that. But for the 24 hours before Pesach starts, don't have any hot chametz. Okay, so also another way to look at it, Rosh Hashanah Zalman Auerbach, okay, who wore dentures for whatever period towards the end of his life, kashered his dentures before Pesach, okay? And he recommended that before Pesach, I'm not sure if he only said this for people with dentures, could be he said this for everyone, he said, take a sip of the hottest tea, you know, water, whatever temperature you would normally use for tea during the year, take a sip of that before Pesach, and that way it will also constitute a form of kashering your teeth, okay? Now, watch out, okay? That's another thing. I'm not sure you want to try that at home unless you really know what you're doing. Okay, you got to get one of those probe thermometers, make sure you're safe over here. So there definitely was that approach, okay? But here's one, we'll leave the dentures on the side. But for our teeth, here's one thing which I think may solve everything. Following scenario, true story, okay? This is recorded in the Chassam Sofer and a couple other postkim from that generation, because it was more, I guess it was more of a commonplace occurrence. If you lived in a house and you had, I don't know, chickens in your backyard or whatever you were raising in your courtyard, you have your macaroni and cheese on the stove, and a chicken jumps in through the window and jumps into your pot. Okay?
All the time.
Okay? So this happened. Okay? It's a real story. Okay? And then the animal jumps out. Okay, so what do I do with my macaroni and cheese? Any suggestions? Okay?
Don't eat it, but it has nothing to do with
it. Okay, so I'm not sure the hygienic standards were quite the same as what you're working with, but that's a good etza. Okay, so that's a shiloh. So what do you do with it? Okay, so I think we're actually talking.
But the animal is not fleshic.
Oh, okay, so what is it?
The animal is not anything yet. It's not been cooked.
It's not been, but it's an animal. I mean, it's not dairy.
What does that have to do with basar v'chala?
It's a chicken.
It's not. It's yeah, but it's a live chicken.
And it fell into a boiling hot pot.
Okay. And out.
Okay, so let's. It's, okay. That's true.
If you can leave the pot, then it's not fussing.
So stop in your back.
Okay, so the taste. So hold on one second. So there are a couple angles to this. Okay, one is a basar v'chala perspective. Okay, which you're convinced, and you're gonna have to prove this to me. Okay, but you're saying that if it didn't get stuck, it was there for 10 seconds. Okay, until it hopped its way out. Okay, but you're saying okay, it's good because it wasn't cooked. And it, you know, runs along and goes back out the window. So even if that's correct, okay, which we could discuss, what about Iver Menachai? right? There's a separate prohibition that applies to Jews and non-Jews not to eat from a living animal. Okay.
You're not eating from a living animal.
It's but the taste transfers. It works across the board. Tom of an Isser is, you know, creates Isser. That's the reality. Okay. It doesn't matter what type of Isser you're talking. We don't think about these terms because we're not usually cooking live animals in our.
I'm standing next to a cow and my ice cream falls onto the cow. Is that now Buster McCullough?
Well, luckily, it's all cold.
Okay. It's all fine. I have my coffee.
Don't have hot.
Okay. So you're making an excellent point. If you look at source 25 is a piece from the Stipler Gaon, Rav Yisrael Yaakov Kanievsky, and he, I think, is coming at it from a similar perspective, arguing with the Chassam Sofer, who I think prohibited that pot that the chicken jumped into, and he says, "May olam lo shamanu v'lo ra'inu sha'adam hanogea b'maychol roseach." So let's say you pour that hot, hot water for yourself. You're about to put it in the tea bag. You want to see how hot it is. So you stick your finger in to test how hot the water is. So my flesh is also basar. Okay, the basar adam is not prohibited. It's not permitted either. Okay, it's not the same isser as Abram and Achai, but it's no less okay to do. Okay, cannibalism is not a standard Jewish practice. Okay, only in the movies. So nonetheless, in theory, if we took everything to its logical extreme, if you stick your finger inside the tea, you just trafed up your tea. Okay, you trafed up your mug. Okay, you're finished.
This thing okay. You're not doing with it should
get it inside of your mouth already as you're drinking.
Oh, it's okay, like okay, right. So I was thinking about that also. Your gums, your everything in there is along this, you know, is in the same category. If it's exposed to heat, in theory, you're right. It's going to trafe up anything that you put down your throat. If you use that same line of thinking, right? So based on that, the Stipler concludes that it can't be that anything living, anything that's attached to the body, okay, is viable in the context of this the rules of transferring time. And if it's attached to a living being, whether it be the chicken, whether it be my finger, whether it be my gums in my mouth, it's not going to be subject to this to the halachas of kashrus. And as a result. My teeth, by extension, we can say also, as long as it's part of my body, perhaps in the same way I can't give off taste, it also doesn't absorb taste in a halakhically significant manner. And as a result, the whole question's off the table. Because in the same way that my body isn't part of this discussion, so too my teeth can't be part of the discussion, and they're not subject to the rules of transferring time. Okay? Mm-hmm. So that's a real answer you can tell all your dentist friends. Okay? But again, it's not a 100% foolproof, because when you have those fillings, okay, so can you say the same thing when you take an external substance and you attach it to your body? Okay, not so easy to say, okay? Perhaps it needs to be considered more, but once it's not a naturally occurring substance as part of the goof, so then already there's what to question, okay?
Still have a question about dentures.
Right. Okay. So that's why now in retrospect it's not as strange if you hear from Zalman Orbach kasher dentures. Sorry, but you're right. But once that's why I think if you look at the literature, in the postgame going back for the last number of generations, they're always talking about dentures. They're not really talking about teeth as much because they were probably assuming this line of thinking that the teeth are not really part of the discussion. Okay, and the chicken also the fact that the chicken was alive. Means that you don't have to, to take it into consideration. I'm just going to throw out one piece of food for thought. Sorry. Okay. I took you by surprise a little bit before when we were talking about just the notion of how far do we apply the transfer of time? Does it really exist everywhere? Okay. So yes, one approach is to say any prohibited food gives off a prohibited taste. Okay, which again, it makes sense. But it could be that there are some foods, or some, we'll say just edible items, that are not prohibited because, you know, it's like a pig. Okay, there's some things that Hashem said you can't eat because it's treif, it's not kosher. There's some things which are not per se because this is, the forbidden foods, but just to give an analogy, someone once asked, when you talk about Hashem telling Adam and Rishon not to eat from the Eitz HaDaas, okay, so how would we categorize that prohibition? Was it like now that he violated the prohibition, is it like he ate treif? Or is it just that he didn't listen to Hashem and he violated Shabbos instead, right? Was it machalas asuros? Was it a treif piece of food? Or was it in some other category of halacha? So same thing might be true. Rabbi Ganak, the head of the OU, in one of his forums suggests, has proof to this, that the prohibition of eating human flesh might not be the same thing as eating a pig, but rather it's just, you know, just detestable from a social, you know, from a social perspective. How could we degrade our, you know, our dignity such that we're eating other human beings? Okay, so again, that's you won't even think about that. But the bottom line is that if you don't categorize it as a treif halacha, but rather a halacha in, we'll say, you know, good manners and etiquette, okay, so then maybe it's not subject to the rules of Tom altogether. So maybe that's a reason why when I stick my finger in the tea, this tea is still kosher, but not because of its, you know, the fact that it's still attached to my body. Okay, so that's something to think about. But in the end of the day, whether you had the cholent tonight or not, God willing, you can have your cereal for breakfast and still have your chicken soup tomorrow night, Mirtz Hashem. Thank you, everyone, for coming. Thank you very much, Daniel, for hosting and for all the work in putting things together. And Mirtz Hashem, we're looking for volunteers for next time, if Baruch changes his mind. Yeah.